Good evening. You're either watching or listening to Redwood Wonk. My name is Eric Kirk. I'm with Professor Aaron Donaldson. We are here to discuss national news of the day. We are going to start with, well, Trump and January 6th related news. The architect of what was, you know, kind of a bad plan to retain power, but still an attempt to retain power, John Eastman, a judge has called for his disbarment in California, and he has responded to that. He's also been apparently subpoenaed, at least according to him, as part of a lawsuit by officers who were part of the January 6th enforcement in Washington, D.C. He's in a bit of trouble. Again, he is the one who outlined the plan for Donald Trump to be able to stay in power, involving taking over the Department of Justice and a lot of other things that or steps that probably weren't really well planned out, but at any rate, it was an attempt. Meanwhile, the gag order, you know, that we reported on last week, where Donald Trump in the trial that's coming up was instructed not to talk about witnesses, not to talk about court personnel or district attorney lower than the main one, Bragg, who he's facing. He's allowed to talk about Bragg or talk about the judge in public, but nobody else. Decided to go after the judge's daughter. And so the gag order has been expanded. Of course, Trump is responding to that. He's going to push everything he can, look for loopholes. Just a lot more Trump stuff, and we're always talking about Trump stuff, but it's kind of important because John Eastman, if he is in fact going to be disbarred, that's kind of big news, because even if it was a really badly conceived coup attempt, it was a coup attempt. It needs to be recognized as such. And so that's what we're here to discuss. Aaron?
I'm really fascinated to hear if you have a take, Eric, on, you know, what it means to be disbarred. I'm a layperson in that capacity, and all I know is that it means you can't be a lawyer anymore, and that's bad if you want to be a lawyer. But I would imagine that there's a pretty high threshold for the kind of behavior that would be required to take someone's law license away. And this is, of course, because in this country, we really value the democratization of the practice of law. That's very important. And it is one thing to have an idea about the law that might be incorrect, and to float that idea, to talk about that idea. But it is another thing completely to utilize the law, not as a shield, as the famous saying goes, but as a sword, to try to get what you want, as a weapon.
Yeah.
And I think what we have here is obviously a very banal attempt to legalize a coup, as you say. You know, January 6th did not come from nowhere. It was not a spontaneous event. There's a clear story that was built up until that moment. And a fundamental part of that, the crowd in particular chanting, "Hang Mike Pence," that was a shocking moment in American history. And as someone who studies communication, I want to know, like, where does that sentiment come from? And it comes from this kind of, quote, legal theory that this Eastman fellow has, that the vice president of the United States gets to interpret the votes that come before the Senate, as opposed to what everyone in the world thought this person was supposed to do, which is just read the votes and say, here's what happened. And because he was spreading this, quote, simple idea, it's just a simple interpretation of the law, but not like in, you know, just legal spaces, as part of a political campaign to maintain power in the face of overwhelming evidence that he has lost, over 60 court cases saying you have lost, there's nowhere else for them to go. This is a major and significant and consequential weaponization of the law. So I feel like this should sail over that threshold, whatever it is. And I'm just curious, is he clearing the threshold by a lot? Am I describing that even accurately? Are there other ways that lead to disbarment? How does that work?
Well, I mean, the idea was to pressure Pence into not recognizing the votes. Now, he doesn't have that power, as everybody has said, his position is ceremonial. It's not in the Constitution. It was something that Congress created as a ceremonial policy. But
that's by design. That's by design to protect the voting apparatuses of the states. That's really essential to the way that we do elections.
but part of the plan was to have the pressure on state legislatures that were Republican majority to disavow the vote and replace them with their own quote-unquote fake electors, as they're being called now. They put up their own slates of electors to have the Republican majority legislatures replace them from the votes, because it does say in the Constitution that legislatures can choose them. But what that means is they select, they put up the processes by which they're selected, and the legislatures had already set that up by election processes. So it was going to be a mess there. And they wanted to have basically take over the Department of Justice by putting Jeff Clark in, who was an environmental law attorney in the Department of Justice, no experience in taking over, but basically he was a sycophant who was going to do what Trump wanted, and including possibly seizing voter machines in 8 different states. And the only reason that didn't happen was because lawyers across the country in the Department of Justice were threatening to quit, and Trump actually backed down on that. I mean, and so this was a multifaceted plan, obviously not conceived, didn't have support from the military, which is kind of what you need from a coup, for a coup, right? So it wasn't really going to succeed, but it was, in fact, a plan to frustrate the Constitution and not have it happen on that date. I mean, people, we're probably, it's a mistake to really say January 6th, because it really was a multi-level plan to have it. Everybody thinks, oh, it was just that demonstration or that tourist, you know, trip, you know, and stuff. It was much bigger than that, but it wasn't well put together. It wasn't well organized.
It was violence on the steps of the Capitol. And I would push back a little bit. Like, it didn't have the legitimate military, but like militia showed up, and right. This country organizes itself around that militia mentality. It wasn't a super organized military effort, but they dressed the part and wanted to look the part and spoke the part, kind of a cosplay militia. But I mean, that's a coup. It's a soft coup, but it's a coup.
It is. But the real things that went in motion, they were hoping to take over the Department of Justice. They failed in that. That was the big one. And they were hoping that a lot more things would be in line before that. They hoped that state legislatures would go along with them. They hoped that more Republicans would go along with them. They hoped that there would just, everything would be in chaos, and that Trump could just come in, take the voting machines, cancel the election, and then do and they really hoped that this would happen. And what everybody says is, well, it was inept, and so we don't have to take it very seriously, right? But the point is that this was an actual bona fide attempt at this. Had it been better organized, it maybe it would have been successful. Had he had backers in the U.S. military, maybe it would have been successful, right? Had he been able to stack the DOJ with more supporters, maybe it would have been successful. The fact that it was inept is irrelevant. This was a serious attempt. So the court in California takes it very seriously. Being disbarred means you lose your license, not suspended. You lose your license. Maybe you can apply to have it set aside someday, but that is, you know, people get suspended for various things. If you're showing incompetence, or if you misuse your trust account, you know, or you violate confidence, or you know, or steal from your clients, you can possibly even avoid disbarment for things like that, right? But for it to be disbarred, it's got to be serious. Has to be like repetition things that give you million chances, right? But for you to be disbarred on your first offense of something, it's got to be a serious thing.
I would imagine you could be disbarred for, like, you know, drinking and driving and like murder.
No. It's drinking and driving can be it, if it's a repetitious thing, but there have been times when people, for instance, they tried to get somebody out back in the 60s because he kept getting into fights, bar fights. But it's really about your honesty and integrity as an attorney. And they say you can be a violent SOB, but that doesn't mean you're dishonest and are going to violate your fiduciary obligations. Now, this got caught up at one point because at one point the bar refused to disbar somebody for domestic violence. But that got turned around because the court said, well, no, that is a fiduciary violation, because when you marry somebody, that person trusts you, puts their trust in you. And if you are committing domestic violence, you are actually violating somebody's trust. So that was different than walking into a bar and picking a fight with somebody you don't know. Right. So, but it's so different things can lead to it. Not paying your child support can get you disbarred, or discipline. I mean, it won't get you disbarred the first time, but a series of it, could get you in theory disbarred. So, but it's really about your how you function as an attorney, and it's really about your honesty or your integrity in terms of whether or not you can perform as a fiduciary. So drinking and driving, if it becomes to the level of a crime of moral turpitude, yes, but if it's a one-time thing, you'll probably get what's called a private reprimand. And saying, okay, this was a one-time thing, stop it, don't do it again. A second time, it'll probably be a public reprimand, which means everybody knows, you've gotten it. Third time, they might say, you got a problem, or even the second time, they might say, you also got to get in and get some alcohol treatment. And that's one thing that the bar can mandate, that you get addiction treatment. As a condition of maintaining your license. I mean, there's a lot of different stuff. It even offers programs now. I mean, it's come a long way.
Honestly, really enlightening to me, because I had a very different interpretation of how that worked. I do want to get, we're almost on time here in the first segment, but I want to get one more question to you on this gag order. Trump immediately violates whatever's put on him. And again, as a lay person here, I'm wondering what everyone's wondering. I'm seeing this question on every channel. And again, I just want to ask a lawyer, why is he allowed to threaten the family of the judge without any kind of, like, what does he have to do? At what point will the court put meaningful repercussions on this man? Like, what does he have to do?
The only thing that's shut him up so far is finally getting hit with an $83 million judgment against E. Jean Carroll. He's not going after her anymore, right? He's not talking about her much in public. That's done it. Until somebody throws him in jail for acting up in court.
To someone who's it shouldn't matter that he's the leading candidate. It should not matter. But that's what he keeps saying. And that's what a lot of people are telling me, is that they don't want to do that to the leading candidate. I'm like, what if he's a criminal, though? That's exactly what
you're wrong. If he acts up in court, they ought to be fining him at first. And then if he keeps acting up, throw him in jail. Until there's consequences, he's going to keep doing it.
Yeah. And they're hesitant to impose those consequences because of the political impression, the blowback that explains that, you think?
I think it's just because he's Donald Trump and they're afraid to do it because it's going to cause a lot of problems, because they're going to think he's being oppressed, and the press will think that it's politically motivated. Yeah. But they got to get over that.
It's really frustrating, because that means that that the law doesn't work the same for all people. Like, you can do a lot of things to a judge in a courtroom and get away with them. And that's just obviously very aggravating for a lot of people.
He's a rich white guy with a lot of power, and that's what it reveals.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Ready? So there have been a lot of talk about third-party runs in this race. As of today, the No Labels has decided to drop their run for or push for a third-party candidate, mostly because nobody seems to be interested. Everybody they've approached has just kind of dropped the idea. But Cornel West, well, he came in second in California for the Peace and Freedom Party campaign. His campaign doesn't seem to be gaining traction. Jill Stein, it seems to be the same old, same old. And other third-party candidates either just aren't showing interest. But the one that seems to be gaining traction and causing some concern among Democrats and Republicans, because it's kind of a mystery as to who he will affect the most in the end, is Robert Kennedy Jr. And he has got some attributes that appeal to some elements of both parties, of different people. Now, there are people on the left who appreciate him because he does talk to some left-wing points. But he also does have some kind of the conspiracy theory elements of the right. Anti-establishment has been at least perceived as anti-vaccine, whether or not that's totally fair. And today he's, come out with his or statement or resurfaced a statement where he talked about how a lot of the mass shootings are caused by antidepressants and video games. And John Cooper came out and said, I'm sorry for the language, but he's an effing idiot. That type of responses. David Hogg says, wow, I had no idea that America is the only country with antidepressants and video games. But it's just, but the anxiety is primarily with the Democrats right now, because according to the polls, at least at current, he cuts into Biden's leads, votes more than Trump's. However, some of Trump's people are attacking him as well, because they are concerned that that in the long run, Biden could chip away at that, and then he's standing there taking votes away from Trump if there are never Trumpers. The thing I find, though, is the never Trumpers aren't the type of people who would vote for someone like Robert Kennedy. If Christie was running, some of the never Trumpers might run for him. But the type of people who might consider Robert Kennedy if Trump wasn't in the race would hurt somebody like Christie or Nikki Haley. So I don't think there's a whole lot of worry about that, unless Trump was to kind of start selling out in a way. Then there would be a problem if Trump was to start moderating some of his positions to try to grab the center, or maybe like when he started moderating his position on abortion or something like that, he might be in some kind of trouble. But I don't, but again, we don't know what he's going to say. We don't know what Robert Kennedy's going to say. He's a wild card, but this is a big factor, and both parties are developing their Robert Kennedy strategy. Robert Kennedy himself is enjoying the spotlight, is finally getting some of the media attention he has. Of course, he is demanding to be in part of the debates, which I don't think either party is going to want. But he is slated to be a factor. Whether he gets 5 or 15%, that's a significant amount of votes that will probably come from Biden. I think Biden could probably neutralize it, because I think that the biggest vote away from him will be the protest vote that votes for him because of the Middle East issue. Because if Biden is perceived as being weak in standing up to Netanyahu, quite frankly, but we'll talk about that in the next segment. But he is a Democrat. The whole family, the whole Kennedy family, has turned on Robert Kennedy about this. But he is qualified for the ballot in North Carolina. That is a battleground state that maybe Trump probably wouldn't win anyway, but it certainly, you know, makes it a lot less likely that Biden would win it. But who knows? Maybe he mostly takes votes that wouldn't have gone to Biden anyway. I don't know, but there's a bit to discuss here on Peel, because he is a potential spoiler factor in this election. Aaron?
I think it's a little frustrating because he is replicating a lot of the same mistakes that people made when Trump rose to power in the first place, in that we're kind of normalizing a candidate that I don't think we would normally normalize. To characterize him as anti-vaccine, he pushes back on that quite a bit, but that was literally the reason that his family gave in the article that they wrote as to why they, as his family, are like disowning his candidacy, was because of the way that he cast doubt and spread fear, particularly with regards to COVID-19 and the efforts to combat COVID-19 and the vaccine that followed. His new vice president, Nicole Shanahan, she is explicitly anti-vaccine. She talks a lot about vaccine injuries as though this isn't something that vaccine developers track with incredible care. And she's been linked to conversations linking vaccines to autism, which again and again and again, like every time you have to say that as a debate coach, I teach people, just having the debate can normalize two sides. And there are reasons that we won't have certain debates if they fundamentally misrepresent the facts as we know them, then having the debate itself can misrepresent the facts as we know them, and we don't want to do that. And I feel like that's kind of what we're doing with RFK Jr. His vaccines and autism stuff, there's election denialism going on, January 6th revisionism stuff. He's got 5G conspiracy background. You mentioned the psychopharma and media links to mass shootings. This is something we should care much more about than to get, you know, feedback like that from a potential president. This is all very Trumpy. And to me, I think that because of Trump, we have a candidate now that could maybe pull some of his votes. And people are talking about how he could pull some Biden votes. And I'll talk about that just here in 2 seconds. But I just think it's unfortunate that we're even going to be talking about him as much as we are between now and November. There's many nauseating things about this election, and this to me is one of them. The poll that I'm interested in, and I don't want to put too much on any one poll, but the New York Times Siena poll that looked at voters from 18 to 29 in six battleground states found that RFK Jr. could potentially be leading both Biden and Trump amongst young voters. And when you look at both politicians, that's a demographic that I think is particularly concerning to them. I think Donald Trump's vote is not growing with women, for sure. It's growing with men. You're seeing, you know, men of color across demographics following right. Trump. But they need the youth vote. And that's where you're seeing some of the gains that they're really pushing for. RFK Jr. has explicitly said he's going on a lot of podcasts so that he can try to get these folks. And then there's the concern with Biden. I think that the difference is that the youth vote that aren't going to vote for Biden, my guess is they're not going to be super pumped about RFK Jr. either. Like they're just not going to vote. And with Trump, I think that the concern is that a lot of people, frankly, fairly, finally, are burnt out on the cruelty and the criminality. And there's a lot of both with Trump, and it is just a deluge. And I think that RFK Jr. gives you all of the same kind of conspiratorial what-if-ism and, you know, anti-establishment stuff, but without that cruelty and criminality. And I think he could siphon some of those votes from Trump. And I don't know, you know, state by state how significant that is, but I think it's interesting. By and large, I see him as less of a threat to Joe Biden than to Donald Trump. But, you know, it's kind of hard to read just based on the kind of coalitions. The only other note that I would make on this is that if he's going to pull votes from Biden, Crystal was talking about Buttigieg's famous greeting to future former Republicans. There's a lot of future former Republicans out there, and they're looking for somewhere to go, and they could go to Biden to defeat Trump. But it's possible RFK Jr. means they don't have to vote for the enemy, the devil, the Democrats. It's like the worst thing in the world for them. So it gives them a chance to vote for someone who's not one of those. But if their whole MO is to defeat Trump, we must defeat Trump, I think they would see that as a big gamble. And if their allegiance truly is to defeating Trump, they're going to wish they could vote for RFK Jr., but hopefully they'll pinch their nose and vote for Biden, because he's truly the only person that has a chance to do that.
I think that what I read is that the Democrats' strategy is pretty much one of their biggest strategies in the election, and it's also their what they're hoping will be their silver bullet with Robert Kennedy, which was Kennedy's real misstep in how he worded his stance on abortion, which he's now trying to backtrack from, which, you know, was to ban all abortion after 3 months. And now he's trying to say he didn't say that, but they're going to tag him with that, because the abortion issue is basically what has been winning every single special election for Democrats, or not winning everyone, but having them outperform every single poll in special elections since the Dobbs decision came down, including the last one. And by bringing youth vote out, and they vote on that issue. This is what is benefiting Democrats everywhere, and they've managed to get the abortion issue on the ballot in Montana, and now one is going up in Arizona. I mean, and so they will use this against Trump, and they will use this against Kennedy, and they'll use it in just about every race they can. And every time, I mean, this last one in Alabama, where, you know, the race was roughly even, and then all of a sudden the Democrat won by 25 points, was probably fueled by the fact that they were discussing the potential ban of the abortion pill in the Supreme Court the day before. You know, which would have been the first time the Supreme Court or that abortion rights were restricted in blue states nationwide. It looks like the Supreme Court is probably going to reject that, with the possible exception of Clarence Thomas and Alito. But it's again, this has been their winner. They're going to use that against Robert Kennedy, and that's probably going to take away a lot of the youth votes. But still, in a close election, you know, any amount of votes lost are crucial.
And I do think that it's, you know, hard to predict. I think that he is a fascinating case study in, you know, the middle ground between two old white men. They're both in their 70s, 80s. They're both in their 80s, and RFK Jr. is in his 70s. And, you know, by the standards of definitely these young voters that we're talking about, that all clears the bar of old. Like, I'm in my 40s and they tell me I'm old. So I'm pretty sure if you're in your 70s or your 80s, this same demographic is going to look at you with the same kind of age discrimination lens that we see going on. He doesn't solve any of those problems.
Right.
But he is, you know, as far as third party candidates go, he's an interesting possible permutation of the two party politics that we see. There's a lot of hubbub. I was watching some News Nation and stuff like that, and they were like, why isn't he getting more media time? And they're showing these charts about how Biden and Trump are getting thousands of mentions and he's getting like 52. And they're talking about how he's in striking distance. They keep saying striking distance. And a lot of people get within striking distance of the major two parties and they're never going to sniff the White House. Like, that's just not really how it works. And I think that when you look at folks like Cornel West, frankly, or, you know, the Green Party, if you can take or leave their politics, but at least they have policy proposals that are rooted in like evidence that we can agree to disagree about the evidence. It's not the 5G conspiracy theory stuff. It's not the, you know, right, COVID-19 conspiracy theory stuff. Like, the media doesn't want to touch that stuff because just giving it a platform is kind of normalizing it in a lot of ways. And again, he's like a lot of like, you know, what if, and just as someone who studies debate itself as a form of learning, as a form of discovery of the truth, that is very destructive if we do it from a baseline that doesn't factually represent what we know and what we understand. That can be problematic. So I don't know. I think he's just another wrinkle, like I said, that's going to make everybody nauseated between now and the end of the election. Do you have any parting thoughts on him in this last minute?
Well, you know, I mean, politicians, older politicians can get around the age issue. I mean, Bernie Sanders is older than Biden.
They have until now. Not a lot of spring chickens. Obama's looking pretty youthful.
Right. Yeah. I mean, But the fact of the matter is there's old and there's old. Bernie Sanders is still doing basketball layups, and he goes on to Fox News and they try to do him, and he comes back right back at him. You know,
it's so a tragic debate. Yep. And that's a good test for me. So,
yeah. So at any rate, but it is what it is. Biden seems old, and now Trump is starting to seem old for the first time. So, yeah, it is going to be a little disappointing, but that's for a lot of people. But that's where we're at. But we'll probably be discussing RFK again because he is there, and it looks like he's in the race to stay. Talking about the ongoing war, if you can call it. I mean, it's a slaughter, unfortunately. And I don't agree with calling it genocide, but maybe it's de facto genocide. It's in its obsession to get at Hamas. The Israeli military has killed, I think we're close to 40,000 people now in Gaza, and it's apparently planning to go into Rafah, which is like the last possible refuge where everybody went, where they're supposed to be safe. And the question is where does Joe Biden say enough? I mean, Biden has said in the past, well, maybe we're going to condition the use of weapons and blah, blah, blah. And we discussed on this show that there was actually an article in one of the Israeli papers, one of the more progressive papers, that says that if Biden was to cut off military aid, it might not actually have any effect. It could lose whatever limited influence that Biden has. Okay, fine. But there's got to be a point where allies, you know, of Israel have to say, this is enough. I mean, you can't do this anymore. I mean, it is way past. In the past, it's always been Hamas does something stupid and brutal, and then Israel overreacts and kills 10 times as many people that Hamas does, and then it's over. But we're way past that. Hamas killed 1,200 people, all of them innocent, and then and we're at 40 times that now. So it's just, and it's not stopping. On top of it, we've got most recently relief workers being killed, central kitchen workers killed, and there's questions whether they were deliberately targeted. I don't know that that's true. I don't know why that would be true, but it doesn't matter. They were killed. I mean, it's when you're just going all out and you're not taking care, it's going to happen. I mean, you know, we already know that some of the hostages that they're supposedly trying to rescue have been killed. Some of them just directly when they were trying to surrender. I mean, there's an old saying that Golda Meir said, which was taken quite well, you know, when the Palestinians love their children more than they hate us, there'll be peace. Well, I think at this point, you know, you can question, that when the Israeli military loves their hostages more than they hate Hamas, maybe there'll be peace. But it's just it is an obsession to this point, and they're not stopping. And so at what point does Biden finally publicly say, this is enough, and take a hardline stand, not just, well, maybe we'll change our policy, but a hardline stand, say Netanyahu enough, and maybe call on the Knesset to say, you need to take a vote of no confidence because this guy is just a mad dog who is apparently fighting this war to stay out of jail. I mean, you got to just take that stand and isolate Netanyahu at this point. He's got a few other allies around the world, Modi, you know, in India, and a few other people who are kind of crazy themselves. But, this is not a typical, he's not Golda Meir. He's not Rabin. He's not any of these other people. It's not, this isn't even a question about Israel's right to exist. This is just, at this point, murder. And it needs to stop. When does it stop? And at what point? And this is probably, by the way, Biden would probably be further ahead in the polls, because there are probably a lot of people who are Democrats who are not supporting Trump, but who are probably in that big undecided claim, who, may even end up voting for Biden in the long run just because they don't want, authoritarianism in this country, but who are in the polls saying they're not supporting Biden because of this. This is probably the biggest detriment to Biden's campaign at this point. I mean, he's caught up in the year's tradition of the Democrats and Republicans, the bipartisan support for Israel, no matter who's in office. But, let's remember how this guy came to power. His party assassinates an Israeli leader, and the Israeli voters rewarded that party by electing him 30 years ago, right? A little over that. So when does it end? And Biden is, by the way, does sound like he's putting up a little more pressure, but I just think he needs to come off as being a little bit tougher. Like, no, we're not going to send you more weapons. I don't care if it's not going to have an effect. We're cutting you off. But anyway.
We're recording this here in the early days of April, and October is not that long ago. And as you said, 40,000 people have been killed, so many more displaced, wounded, the lives of generations of Palestinians obviously just totally shattered. It's really horrific to look at the scale of the devastation that can take place in just a small period of time with the acquiescence of the world. As a pacifist, they'll say we're going to have peace when people love peace more than anything else. That's what it takes, is loving peace. And, terrorists know that it is hard to love peace when you strike indiscriminately and generate tremendous fear. And terrorists are going to thrive off of that fear. And, the context that I think is important in understanding Biden's reluctance here, first and foremost, is just understanding how this is very much a direct extension of our own so-called war on terror, where, we indiscriminately kill and displace millions of civilians across Iraq and Afghanistan and other countries, including aid workers that we will deliberately target. It's a mistake because we think there's someone else, but it's very deliberate, and that the ordnance comes through the roof of the vehicle that they are in and picks off every vehicle in a row. Like, it's very deliberate in those instances, and we will justify that with a existential rhetoric of us versus them, against these groups that are truly dependent on a disproportionate blowback. Like, you fly airplanes into the Twin Towers and you do something like, what happened in October, that happens so that you will generate that disproportionate response. And that disproportionate response then paves the way for those groups to say, look at the monster bringing war across the world. So Biden is as invested in that rhetoric, which makes it hard to say, quote, Israel, can't defend itself. The way they phrase it is like Israel has a right to defend itself and a right to exist. And as horrific as what Hamas did truly is, it's truly horrific. It's not going to topple Israel. Like, this isn't an existential attack on Israel. No. That's a hyperbolic claim designed to take the war on terror to an existential place, so that we can justify asymmetric slaughter across years of military effort. And so that rhetorical construct, I think, is very important for the Democrats. It's very important for the Republicans. It pays a lot of bills when the ordnance gets sold and the vehicles and the jets get sold. So that's very important for them. And the second one, obviously, that is truly horrific, but I think factual, is that it is an election year. And I think that the people that Biden might get by finally getting hard on Netanyahu now, they're going to be like, too little, too late. And more importantly, those people don't understand the comparative. if they're not voting for Joe Biden because of how he has responded to the war in Palestine, then like Donald Trump is not better. Like he's just worse. Right. He'll do that, but worse. And so those people fail to understand the comparative. I don't know that him taking a hard stance now is going to win them back, but it could absolutely pave a lot of, you know, conservative talking heads to say really extreme things about how he doesn't support Israel. It puts arguably the whole state of Florida in play, which is one that they really want to win. There's a bunch of other, you know, like key demographics that, you know, abandoning Israel in the hour of need, radio listeners, there are large quotes being put around that phrase, that's a political death knell. And until November, he can't do a thing about it. And frankly, I think Netanyahu knows that. And he's going to test, he's going to see how far he can go. Because as of, you know, 37 minutes before we recorded, the New York Times is reporting that Biden has told Netanyahu U.S. support hinges on treatment of civilians in Gaza, calling the killing of the aid workers, quote, unacceptable. Like, that is not, that's not even tough talk. Like, we're not even talking turkey. Sure. We got to be like no more ammunition. The jets that you are just about to purchase are not coming. I'm with you. I think he should start like physically calling for a vote of no confidence. This man is hiding from prosecution by staying in office. That alone is justification to support a vote of no confidence. And that would be true here if we need it sometime in like December. I don't know. But the point is simply that I think those two things explain Biden's reticence, the war on terror rhetoric and just the politics of it. And it's horrifying.
The Haaretz article I was referencing before said that if we actually stop giving them ammunition, the bombs that they've got that they would reference are actually bigger and would kill more people. And it's like, you know, that, and at first I thought, well, okay, but, and then, well, actually that's kind of a thing, you know, it
may or may not be true, but at that point, like there's other modes of accountability, you know. Right. The fact that Israel's been able to stockpile so many bombs and have so many resources to find bombs and all that isn't a justification for us to be complicit by giving them ours, you know?
Right. Exactly. And at this point, and, you know, the other thing is, would it make them vulnerable to attack? I doubt it. I mean, Hezbollah is not a threat to them. It's like, you know, it's, at least not an existential threat. It's kind of like 9/11. Yeah, they can kill some people. But it's not a threat to the Republic. I mean, it's just, you know, that's, and I don't want to downplay that. Killing people is bad, but it's just, it's not.
Most importantly, warfare isn't going to fix that. They will continue to be able to recruit very small numbers of people to do very horrific things. Yeah. And the way that they do that, they rely on that, are these legacies of military apathy, frankly. In the United States, Osama bin Laden is clear pointing at our presence in the Middle East, and Hamas is clear pointing at, you know, Israel's bombings of Gaza. That, like, I look at 2014, I look at now, like, there's a long legacy here, and each time they'll point the finger first and foremost at the so-called terrorist group, but that terrorist group is there with a history behind it that gets reenacted every time they can get 12 to, you know, 300 people to do something.
I just wish that also that there's at some point they would get an Israeli regime in there that understands that this is exactly what Hamas wants.
Yes.
I mean, this is the reaction that they were looking for. Correct. Right. They're not going to all be killed. Some of them will be killed, but that you can't defeat that type of, you know, I don't even want to call it a resistance, you know, forced this way. We learned that in Vietnam, or maybe we didn't, but, you know, that's, you can't do it. You can't, you know, okay, you've got the sea that supports them, drain the sea. It doesn't work. You can't do that.
The only way they can recruit is by saying it's the only possible option. And if they're standing on the ashes of a hospital that they may or may not have been occupying prior to that, it's a lot easier. And if you indiscriminately destroy that hospital to try to root them out and blame them for hiding behind civilians, you're just playing into their hands.
Right. No, I mean, the point of that is, you know, when quote unquote terrorists do that, is unfortunately it should work. You can't kill them there. You know that you just can't do it. You do the thing. I mean, you know, I say, okay, you go into the tunnels and you're going to lose people, but you do it with the special forces. I mean, you know, for years, the Israeli people went on stealth missions and grabbed Nazi criminals, right? They didn't go fly in and bomb everybody to get them. They went in and grabbed them. They could probably do some of that with Hamas, right? I mean, it's just, it's, I do the intelligence and work it up. I'm not saying that it's a win all, but this is not how you win this war. You know, you're not going to win this militarily. You got to win it I think the first thing they ought to do is say, we're pulling all of our settlers back past the green line if you will recognize Israel's right to exist. That would be a radical thing. If somebody in Israel, some leader in Palestine will recognize Israel's right to exist, we will pull them back. And they, and we will do it forcefully if we need to. I mean, that's going to be a radical position. And unfortunately, that's going to be a real bloody thing itself, because a lot of settlers will, but that's been something that's been going on so long. You know, it's not going to be a clean thing, but that's something that needs to happen. And it's just, and there have been proposals to do that, but it's just, and so what does the president do? I mean, I don't know what Biden should do. I don't know that taking a tough stand is going to have any effect. Netanyahu is a nutcase, but it's what we're dealing with.
It'd be a pretty long-term stance. We're pretty much out of time here, but I would just end by saying that a short-term rebuke of a single delivery of anything is not going to make a difference. Yeah. It would require the United States to systematically redefine its relationship with Israel. But when you look at not only the settler politics, but also, again, the so-called war on terror politics, they're very, very similar. And for whatever it's worth, I think when you look at Vladimir Putin and his justifications for the war in Ukraine, you see very, very similar rhetorical work there, too. The war on terror just has tremendous legacy when it comes to justifying the unilateral beginning of a war in the name of existential defense. And that comes and starts right here at our own doorstep.
Yeah.
Eeny, meeny, chili, beeny, the spirits are about to speak.
Are they friendly spirits?
Friendly? Just listen.
Oh, there it is. Okay. All right. Let me know when you're ready.
I'm good.
Okay. Well, this brings us to predictions. Aaron, what do you have?
I just want to throw this into the world. The Republicans have been using this term lawfare. It's like warfare, but like with the law. They think that Trump is the victim of the warfare of the law, and that's what's going on. And I think this explains his provocative, like, vocabulary and rhetoric towards all of the judges. I'm not the only person saying it, but I really do feel like he's daring them to put him in jail. I feel like he's going to try it, and I feel like it's possible he does jail time before the election. I don't know when. I don't know how long. It's probably wishful thinking, but that's my prediction.
Okay, well, that's exciting news. Mine is a little bit less exciting, but Nebraska's legislature has rejected Trump's call to get rid of its proportional allocation of its electoral college votes. It is currently one of two states in which each congressional district gets to decide how its electoral college votes go, and in past elections, several of them, have gone red to the Republican, but the blue dot, which is the second congressional district, which incorporates Omaha, which is the biggest city in the state, has gone in the past to Democrats, went to Obama, later to Biden. I am predicting that it will once again go to Biden in November, because it has actually become bluer with the changing demographics and people moving into it. So that is my prediction. Joe Biden will win the blue dot in November. We'll see if that comes true. In the meantime, stay informed and stay engaged.